big job in Washington. Well, today, I guarantee, if I were Ronald Reagan, I'd be relaxing at my California ranch with an ocean view, letting the world go by. But the good Lord must have made Ronald Reagan part workhorse. Part workhorse. For instead of gazing out over the Pacific, here he is on a Sunday afternoon, 2,000 miles from home in Wichita, Kansas, participating in one more Ag Day salute to the American farmer. How about that?
All right, yeah!
Until 1975, Ag Day, the annual effort by volunteers to tell the farmer's story to the consumer, had only been tried in two states, Iowa and Minnesota. The very first spokesman of national stature to put his name in his radio program and his newspaper column into the effort to make Ag Day a 50-state program was a rancher from California by the name of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, he wrote in an understandable and very convincing way about our subject, agriculture. In 1977, when John Wayne was Ag Day spokesman, it was Ronald Reagan's words that saved the day. John Wayne had rejected all scripts, and the commercial was to be filmed the next day, until the Duke declared, "Well, why don't we just take some of those great words that Reagan wrote?" We did, and perhaps you remember them.
Beautiful, isn't it? A certain crash in Vegas is like a guaranteed annual income compared to ranching and farming. Running too little, too early, too later, too much, disease and insects, all of those things. Like a farmer, he bets his whole role every year. Family's well-being, his kid's future, everything he has to feed you. So at least once a year on Agriculture Day, don't cuss that farmer. Let's appreciate it.
Appreciate it. And if John Wayne were still around, he'd be standing here recommending the man he knew firsthand would stand up for agriculture. For all of Governor Reagan's Ag Day involvement and leadership, we finally mailed him an award a couple years ago. But we mailed him something that most ranchers and farmers don't have to have explained. A single tree. For the benefit of the visiting media, a single tree, that's the device that slings behind the horse, below the tail, to which you attach the old-time plow. Today, on this salute to Agriculture Day, it is fitting to re-present in person this award, so that Kansas farmers have an opportunity to express their thanks in person. Mr. Governor, will you please join us? The inscription from the Ag Day Foundation read, "In sincere appreciation for pulling more than your share of the load on Ag Day, Ronald Workhorse Reagan."
Thank you. I'm delighted to have this, and I know where it originally was supposed to hang, but you might be interested to know where the first one that you gave me is hanging, and that is up in our ranch house. It's hanging by chains from the ceiling, and from that is suspended the lamp that lights the room.
Governor, we also have another presentation which brings in just a little bit of our Western color a little bit. And to make this presentation, I've got Lauren Correll, the manager of Scheffler's, the world's largest Western store, and we've got something we'd like to present to you right now.
Governor, on behalf of everyone here today, we just want you to know that we think you're one politician who isn't afraid to grab the bull by the horns.
And Governor, as a footnote to that presentation, we've got something else here for you, also from Scheffler's. And it's 100% pure bull. We hope that you've got a whole lot more than this left after it's all said and done. And last but not least, it wouldn't be too appropriate if we let someone of Governor Reagan's stature come to town without us officially making him a KFDI Country Club fan and member. So we've got a belt buckle, Rex, and a KFDI hat, a KFDI t-shirt for you. Hey, all right. And now, without further ado, once again, Governor of California, Ronald Reagan.
Thank you very much. I didn't know it was going to be Christmas in March, but I once had, out at our ranch, it's kind of a conversation piece in a landmark, a live one that bore a set of horns like those that just were shown out here. And his name was Uvalde, because that's where he came from, Uvalde, Texas. So I'm delighted with all your generosity and all that you've done, and also the honor of being here. And to hear Duke's voice again with those words, I just whispered there to the gentleman beside me on the chairs there that there went my opening joke. But maybe I can explain it a little bit and where the words came from. Those words about the crap table. I was speaking to the Cattlemen's Association. The convention was being held in Las Vegas. And on my way in, one of those fellows that was there for the action recognized me, grabbed me, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I told him where I was going and what I was going to do. Well, he said, "What's a bunch of farmers doing in Las Vegas?" And I just couldn't resist. I said, "Buster, they're engaged in a business that makes a Las Vegas crap table look like a guaranteed annual income." That's for the line. But I know that my time is limited on monologue, because I know that what we're looking forward to is a dialogue. And by way of questions that have already been provided up here, but let me for a few minutes then just talk to you about some of the problems and the things that bring me here. I recognize that this is not supposed to be a partisan gathering, but at the same time, I can't help but be critical of the problems confronting us today and the part that the administration has played in. When I heard him last week talking to us about inflation, I don't know why I should have thought of this, but I did, as I listened to him speak, that a man who tells you he enjoys a cold shower every morning will lie about other things. The American farmer has made this country the envy of every industrialized nation in the world, and the provider, directly or indirectly, with nearly all the world. Because American agriculture is a modern miracle story. I know we've looked at all the electronic miracles and the miracles of travel and space travel and all of that. But the improvement, the increase in the ability of the American farmer to feed not only himself and his own, but to feed additional others, has been probably the greatest technological revolution the world has ever seen. 3 decades ago, Americans spent almost 1/4, 22% of their disposable income for food. And today, in spite of our double-digit inflation, those Americans are only spending 17% of their earnings to put food on the dinner table. And this year, once again, Washington has asked the American farmer to feed and clothe a demanding nation and the world. But even as we enter a new season and a new decade, those in agriculture are raising some pretty sharp questions about the record of the administration's agricultural policies. And they're doing so because the record does not demonstrate an understanding of the farmers' problems, or for that matter, much concern over those problems. The administration's handling of energy has made planting and the harvest seasons a high stakes game of chance. Inflation has made the farmer the greatest victim of the cost-price squeeze. And farm folk, I think, have had about all the lip service, double talk, and meaningless rhetoric from Washington that they need or can stand. And while Mr. Carter's policy surrogates, or political surrogates, I should say, are boasting about 1979's net farm income being the second highest in history, second only to that record that was set in 1973, I hope they also remind their listeners that the figure, that second highest figure of $32.5 billion, just behind the 33 and a fraction billion of 1973, only has the purchasing power today of $20 billion, $1973. By anyone's arithmetic, that is going backward. Uncontrolled double-digit inflation does more to increase costs. It reduces the income, it destroys savings, it kicks people into higher tax brackets as they try to keep pace with the increased cost of living, and it makes it almost impossible for farmers to pass their farms on to their families. In fact, the skyrocketing land prices, high interest rates, the cost of machinery and fuel and fertilizer, one has to ask, how do the sons and daughters of farmers follow their parents into farming today? How does the family farm remain a family farm when the inheritance tax forces the sale of that farm simply to pay the federal income taxes? And this is also a problem today. You have allies and fellow sufferers. This is a problem for the thousands of family-owned shops and stores and other businesses in America. As president, I would sign, not threaten to veto, the repeal of the 1976 carryover basis rule, which now has capital gains tax on top of the federal inheritance tax. Can the inheritance tax really be justified on the basis of needed revenue? It produces less than 1% of the present government's revenue. Therefore, it must have been installed for some kind of social purpose, to meet someone's ideas of redistribution and fairness and equality in this land. Well, I think it is a tax that should be eliminated. And simply like that. But above all, inflation must be controlled. And since government is the cause of inflation, government alone can end inflation. And I would like to try to do just that. All of us have a stake in the energy crisis, none higher than the American farmer. Just last spring, you were faced with the uncertainty over fuel supplies. I happened to be in one of the Plains states at that time when they were just 2 weeks away from the last date by which they could get their crop in the ground, and they still had not received their allocation of fuel as approved by the Department of Energy. Last year's farm exports totaled $32 billion, providing a net trade surplus of nearly $16 billion, a sum which paid for about 1 out of every 3 barrels of oil that this country had to import. Now, I think, I oppose, incidentally, let me interject here, any restrictions on foreign sales except in those rare situations where national security requires that kind of drastic action. And I don't believe that the recent boycott was in such a moment where national security was that threatened. I believe the farmers would be the first in this land to join in a boycott, to bear the sacrifice, if it were a boycott that amounted to a quarantine that shut off all supplies that we're providing to that aggressor, the Soviet Union. But when you were the only ones asked to pay, while at the same time the government had approved a sale of phosphate fertilizer to increase Russia's ability to grow grain by 25%, while we're presently exporting an assembly line to build V-12 diesel oil tank motors, while we had put up the Kama River truck plant, which provided the mechanized equipment that carried the Russian aggressors across the border into Afghanistan, I don't think there was any sense, other than probably someone trying to make political hay, in picking out one group of American citizens to be penalized as you were penalized with the recent boycott. I know that American industry, the shopkeeper, professionals, entrepreneurs, and you, the farmers, virtually all of us have found ourselves increasingly bound in by regulations of a multitude of government agencies having the power of law. Now, however well-intentioned they were, they have made of our government what have put it in the position of being a hostile adversary with its own business and farm community. Now, the choice is not, as some would have us believe, between regulation or no regulation. Certainly, there are certain sensible, reasonable regulations that we all require because government exists to protect us from each other. But unreasonable, nitpicking regulations carried to absurdity, harassing and financially crippling the economy are unnecessary. One example that I know you're familiar with, the law regarding pesticides, for example, provides taking into account not only the hazards of their use, but also the economic, social, and environmental benefits. The Environmental Protection Agency has ignored that part of the law in enforcing the regulations on a no-risk basis. And again, you pay the price, but you're not alone. There are any number of industries in this country falling behind, unable anymore to compete in the international market, mainly because of regulations imposed upon them. We used to manufacture 76% of the automobiles in the world. We now manufacture 38%. And yet General Motors is required to employ 23,300 full-time employees who do not build automobiles, they fill out government forms. We have a senator who says that the government should take over the health care for everyone in the nation. And yet, 164 agencies presently regulate hospitals alone, and it adds $35 per day per patient to hospital costs. I think it is time to have an administration in Washington that will listen and not lecture, that will place in the Department of Agriculture people who believe that the local farmers know more about their own concerns than does Washington, and that it is time to stop pitting the farmer against the city dweller, the producer against the consumer, with politically inspired cheap food policies. But as I said in the beginning, I know that you have concerns beyond your own. You share as everyone else does. Concern for the same issues that are bothering the people who live in the town and the city. Because you too must buy groceries. And you know the frustration of paying 60 or 65 cents for a loaf of bread that only contains a nickel's worth of wheat. Your homes will be just as cold and dark as city dwellers if there's a lack of home heating oil and fuel for our utility plants. And you're just as penalized as the rest of us by unjust and unreasonable taxes. You too are disturbed by the waning strength and the declining prestige of our nation in the world. I would like to talk to you just a few minutes about those other broad problems. I have mentioned inflation, I've mentioned energy, and I've mentioned the international situation. The president talks to us, and to hear him talk, you'd think someone else has been in charge for the last 3 years. I said that inflation was caused by government. It is. It's government spending more than government takes in. It is government grinding out imitation money on the printing presses, flooding the currency market, and lowering the value of our savings, our insurance, our pensions, whatever it may be that we've accumulated. There is an answer, but not the answer the government is presenting to us now, that is going to balance the budget and fight inflation, and it's going to do so really by raising taxes. We could have always balanced the budget by increasing taxes, but there's going to be 10 cents a gallon now on gasoline. There's the so-called windfall profits tax, which isn't. It's a sales tax, really, beginning on the first barrel of new oil. And it's going to be paid by the consumer. It has to be passed on to the price before it can be paid to government. There's going to be the automatic increase in Social Security tax. And then there's going to be equally automatic that increase of people being pushed up into higher income tax brackets, paying a higher percentage. The government is going to get next year from $50 to $75 billion in additional revenue. At the same time, the government tells us we must all purchase less and live more austerely, that we're now at a time when we're baking a smaller pie and everyone must be willing to get along with a smaller slice. This country was built for almost 200 years on the idea that we continually built a bigger economic pie and everyone therefore could have a bigger slice. And we can still have that. I think my idea for fighting inflation would be, number one, to attack that waste and fat with which the federal government is so overladen. Cut down on that bureaucracy, and that would mean in the first 24 hours putting a freeze on the hiring of federal employees to replace those who retire. We eliminate the waste and the fat in the government. You've been reading the stories lately, I'm sure, in your papers, about all the new office furniture in Washington. They've just went out and spent millions of dollars to refurnish the offices, and now someone's discovered they've got warehouses in Washington that have had for the last 10 years all the new furniture they need that was bought and is sitting there, unused. One can find 1,000 examples of that kind of government waste. You know, you're almost as bad as the American Indian now with being outnumbered by Department of Agriculture employees. I don't know whether you know the story about the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a vast expanse of desks. One fellow back in the corner one morning, his head in his arms, crying his heart out. Finally, they persuaded him to tell him what was wrong, and he said, "My Indian died." Why did we have all the energy, all the oil and gasoline we needed from the beginning of the horseless carriage on up to 1971? Why in the last 9, and at the cheapest price of anyone in the world? Why since 1971 have we had increasing scarcity and we've had skyrocketing prices? Because in 1971, the government started running the energy industry, setting the price at the wellhead. Allocating it, determining what would be built. At the same time that through environmental regulations, we haven't built a new refinery in this country in 6 years, and they haven't built a new one on the East Coast for 20 years. There is one gentleman that's been trying to build one for 10 years in Maryland, and he, to date, it's 10 years later and $7 million in legal fees, and he still doesn't have permission. The answer is very simple, and it just depends on common sense. And that is, let's start doing what we were doing for those first 71 years of this century. Let's get the government out of the energy industry and out of that. Yeah. I'll say one word about the international affair, one line or two, and then we're going to get to those questions. Because what has been done domestically in this country is infinitesimal compared to what has happened to the prestige of our nation abroad. Our friends and allies no longer feel they can depend on us, no longer trust us, and the Soviet Union has shown its contempt for us and how much it knows it now outpowers us militarily in the way that the federal in the way of invading Afghanistan. The first time outside their own circle of satellites that they've used their own troops and not proxies or subversion to take over a country. But they crossed that border in the face of a threat by our president, the severe consequences would follow. He was also the one who told us when he discovered that there was a communist brigade in Cuba, a Soviet brigade in Cuba, that it was untenable. We would not hold still for the status quo. That's Latin for the mess we're in. But here it is weeks and weeks later, and the brigade is still there holding war games and maneuvers. We have lost our credibility throughout the world, and certainly we have downgraded our military strength. I asked a general recently in the Air Force, if the Russians should attempt a manned bomber attack, not their missiles, a manned bomber attack with their backfire bombers, I said, how many could get through to their targets in the United States? And he said it would depend on the route they took. He said in a couple of routes we could knock down 13% of them, on the rest, only 4%. In other words, a manned bomber attack on the United States today, we could only, 96 to 87% of their aircraft would get through to the target. It is time for us to start a build-up, a rebuilding of the military might of America. And it is time for us to build that to the point that no other nation on this earth will ever dare raise a hand against us. And in this way, we will preserve world peace, and we're the only ones who can do it. Thank you.
We knew a lot of folks wanted to ask a lot of questions, so we have taken questions the last couple of hours. And our two newsmen, Dan Dillon, will be working to your left, Nelson Schock to your right, and they'll be asking the questions. What we're going to do is when the gentleman that wrote the question, when we call your name, please stand up so the governor can address you.
All right. Governor, first question comes from Paul Lorson of Hope, Kansas. Paul's out there, he'll stand up. The question is, what is your foreign policy prices for foreign products? Cattle, hogs, wheat, and grain.
Well, my policy is that, as I said, I believe I can't spell out for you exactly chapter and verse of what I would do, but I faced something of the same problem in California when I became governor. And the farmer had no voice in Sacramento. And he will have a voice in Washington, D.C., President. But what we must be sure of is that, like in any other business, we've got to recognize the productive costs, the production costs, and we've got to recognize the necessity of the farmer being able to make a profit on his time and his effort and his own gamble and risk. And I do believe that the policy of this government is what I said in my remarks, that there are more consumers than there are farmers, and therefore the policy has all been aimed at soothing the consumer and thus at the expense of the farmer. And there's no excuse for this. I also believe that there is a function for government. While I've talked about government interference and lifting it from the backs of all of us, there is a legitimate place for government. I believe that the President of the United States could take the lead in dealing with other foreign countries and other foreign leaders with regard to the fairness of export trade, that we should not penalize the American farmer by allowing other countries to set quotas and to do things that are unfair in the international competition. And we should use the prestige of the presidency itself, and I believe that we should use the federal government and the prestige of the federal government to improve and increase foreign markets for farm export. And as I say, I wish I could give you chapter and verse on the other, but maybe I could explain it this way. If you want to know exactly how I lean and how I feel, I think that Earl Butz was probably the greatest Secretary of Agriculture in this country ever. I know that under his term, farm net profit was going up 16%, and since then it's been going down 14%. I'd like to go back to the other way.
Governor, our second question comes from a member of the American Agriculture Movement from Pratt, Don Bergner. His question is, Carter lied to the farmers, shattered our faith in our government. Would you support 100% of parity, and would you keep your word?
You know, I'm a little hesitant about saying I keep my word because he said it so many times and didn't. No, yes, I would.
And I wish I could answer the question for you that I know is a technical question, 100% of parity. I have to confess to you that I am not as familiar with some things as that, but I would seek the advice of farm leaders like my former farms director, Alan Grant, who's the head of the Farm Bureau today, and people that I know are interested in farming, as to see what is the proper way to get farming out of the cost price squeeze and into a fair profit. If it is 100% parity, yes, then yes, I would support that.
The next question comes from George Lawless of Belle Plaine, Kansas. He says, will you have or will you take the time to talk to the farmers if they make another tractor cave trip all the way to Washington, D.C.?
I'll do better than that. I'll come see you. I just want you to know, I speak from a record, because it was true. As governor, we did give the farmer in California, and as you know, we're one of the great farm states there. Most people think of us as other things than that, palm trees and so forth, and oil slicks, but we did. And there's plenty of evidence to substantiate it that the farmer got a square deal during our 8 years in Sacramento.
The next question, Governor, is in reference to an area of Kansas called the Tall Grass Prairie. Would you support government intervening and taking over land such as the Tall Grass Prairie?
Now, we come to one that is probably, I need to ask a great many of you people in Kansas how you feel about it, but I will tell you how I feel about what the government is doing with land today. It started back when I was first running for governor. I believe there's been a concerted movement on the part of the federal government to regain control of as much land in this country as it can. I am sympathetic to the sagebrush rebellion that is going on in the western states, where the federal government owns as much as 80 and 90% of some of those states, 43% of my own state, California. It started in 66 as getting land for outdoor recreation, that the federal government had to grab back and take land for that. And at that time, one bureaucrat slipped up and made a statement that we encouraged the development by private individuals of land to begin with in order to get it developed. But now it was necessary for the government to regain control of that land. Well, they finally ran out of outdoor recreational use as an excuse for gobbling up more land. And then the environmental movement came along, and that gave them more of a chance. And today, with oil geologists telling us that Alaska could provide us probably with 5 billion barrels of oil a day instead of 1.6 billion, our federal government has put into a preserve 250,000 square miles of potential oil lands up there and prevented any exploration for it. They have been, through the Wilderness Act, taking out multiple use nationally owned land, like national forest land that has been heretofore open to mineral finding, to mining, to grazing, and so forth. They are taking millions more acres of that and putting it into wilderness areas where you can't even have a wheeled vehicle or a trail or a path through it. I think there seems to be a concerted purpose. What I would need to know from you is how you, the people in Kansas, feel. It seems to me, from having gone through that very area in the Flint Hills, that those who own that land and have been ranching it have been doing a pretty darn good job of preserving it in its natural state. Kansas feel, then you'd have me on your side, because granted that there are beauty spots in this land that we want to keep, we want to preserve, and we've done this with great national parks, scenic areas, and so forth, and this I would support, but I am very suspicious of this land grab that, as I say, I think is going on with the federal government, and I've had a suspicion that this is the way you felt about that particular area there, and that it is unnecessary. It is just another case of the federal government going after more land.
Governor, I believe we have time to just one more question.
One more question. This deals with the Rock Island Railroad, Governor. It comes from Beverly Herbich of Harrington. She wants to know what your opinion is of the Rock Island Railroad closing down. Of course, the railroad line that transported the majority of the grain here in Kansas.
Well, I know that problem, and I know that there are several other areas in the country that have the same problem. And I left out of my remarks so that we would have time for more questions. I guess I didn't leave enough out of my remarks. I talked too long. My own thinking on this, that yes, that one of your great marketing problems is that risk every year that you may find yourself having to dump grain on the ground or put it in elevators, silos, because of a lack of transportation. And I would put as one of the first prime problems for the Secretary of Agriculture and the Secretary of Transportation to get together and to make sure that there is a solution to the farm-to-market transportation of produce by enough cars, rail beds that are serviceable, even water transportation, such as over in Iowa there in the corner where they need some locks to stop the backup there where the locks lead into the Mississippi River and they go down to the Gulf for shipping, for export and so forth. I would turn them loose and insist on a regular report to me as to how they were coming, with guaranteeing to the farmers the transportation they need for getting their produce to market. Could I, since we started with him and that gives him one extra, could I take one more?
I have a good one here, Governor.
Maybe I shouldn't have
let from Ed Eck, Sheriff Kansas. If you are elected, will you do all in your power to save the small family farmer? If so, how will you do it?
Well, I just told you one way, and that was to eliminate that inheritance tax. I think the other way has to be the overall problem of curing inflation and putting us back to where you're not caught in that cost-price squeeze. And remember that when you lick inflation, you also bring down those interest rates. At the present, the plain truth is the interest rates have to keep pace with inflation or no one's going to lend money at all. But today, who can borrow money at the present rate of interest? They're the highest they've been since what I once said before the Civil War, since the Civil War. But in the last few days, I think they've gone up even higher than that, probably the highest in our history. And inflation also, the same thing, and the dollar worth less than it's ever been in our history in relation to other currency. But those overall problems have to be solved. But I think the inheritance tax problem is one way to save it, and then to bring down inflation so that someone can look forward to coming out of agricultural school and becoming a farmer. And I don't know how anyone can today, but the family farm, I think, is the backbone of agriculture in this country. And on your record, you deserve the support to keep this system alive, because there's no other system in the world to compare with it. Do you know of the economic experiment that was made where some economists took the prices of food here in America, and then they compared them to the prices in Soviet food stores where they have the government farming system, great nationalized farms, and they translated the prices into how many minutes and hours an individual had to work in order to pay those prices. And they found that with only one exception, the American citizen could buy for far less minutes of work any one of the food commodities except one than a Soviet citizen could. The one exception turned out to be potatoes. And there it turned out that the price for potatoes worked out to less there than it did in the United States. There was just one hitch. They didn't have any potatoes. So, yes, this is, I fancy myself a part-time farmer with some cattle myself, and it must be preserved. And I would do everything that I could. And as I said, seek the counsel of people who knew the problems here, and not put in a high position in the Department of Agriculture someone whose expertise was in consumer affairs. I think it should be.
Thank you for allowing me to talk to you. Thank you for all those gifts.
I come here soliciting your support, and I'd be very proud and happy to have it. Because overall, my basic philosophy as I exercised for 8 years in California was simply that I believe government has caused most of our problems. And I would like to see that changed and turn loose again the genius of the American people to do what they've done so well for almost 200 years before the government got involved. Thank you very much.